Well, it looks like Archbishop Vigano has been vindicated by some recent documents that have been released showing that Pope Francis, in fact, did lift restrictions off of ex-Cardinal McCarrick. Also, it shows that Wuerl seems to be deceiving us. Is he lying us? Also, Vigano has come out and he has accused the Pope of lying, or at least forgetting what Vigano said. So I'm here today with Tim. Tim, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Good. Lots of news this week.
Lots.
One of the interesting, before we get to Vigano, Pope Francis was in a Mexican interview and he referred to President Trump's wall idea and compared it to the Berlin Wall. Here's the quote right here. People wanted us to just make a comment on it. Mm-hmm. He says, Pope Francis, "We knew of one wall of Berlin and the many headaches and sufferings it caused us, but it appears that man does what animals don't, right? Man is the only animal that falls into the same hole, right? We are returning to the same thing, right? Building walls as if they were defense, right? Defense is a dialogue. Defense is a dialogue, growth, acceptance and education, integration, and the healthy but human limit. No more of this." That's Pope Francis. So he's kind of got the kind of Kanye West, like, where he just puts the same word at the end, like, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no rhyme, no right. Slant rhyme.
No.
Just right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Technically, like, this all rhymed because it all had the same word at the end, which was right.
Uh-huh.
So he compares it to the Berlin Wall, which is interesting because communists built that wall. Socialist communists that built the wall, right? His faves.
Right.
Right. Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's a fair comparison because you have a political ideology in a proximate geographic territory and you want to keep it divided. How do you do that? You put in a wall.
Sure, but the kind of political division, this isn't a show on politics, but the kind of political division at question matters a fair amount. That was weird. I heard passing by car in my earphones here. The kind of political
division matters. They're listening to you, man. They're watching you. Surveillance.
Yeah.
Probably a bug.
Breathing? Yeah. The division between East and West Germany, we don't want to get all the way into it, but I mean, it's distinguishable in a dozen ways, a dozen meaningful ways from the sovereign international government principles that have always and will always distinguish United States from America. So, yeah, the problem with the Nazis and the problem with Germany, with the Soviets after that, you know, when we're talking about the Berlin Wall, you know, post-World War II era, wasn't the wall itself. It was the communists and what
communism.
They did.
That, yeah.
It wasn't. It was actually it's interesting because communism stands for internationalism, which Pope Francis seems to love.
Yep.
And the wall was a unique exception because of the particular exigencies of the East-West Germany ideological divide. So now I've gotten all that out. A wall is sort of a sign of contradiction because what is a communist? It's an international socialist. Right. Anyway, it's usually a sign of nationalism or whatnot. Pope Francis hates that. He doesn't even deal with this distinction, which, you know, any eighth grader would see. Okay, if I'm going to cite this, I need the distinction between U.S. and Mexico. There's literally no other areas of overlap with West East Germany except the fact that there's a wall. The reason for it, you know, the formal cause, the final cause, even the material cause of the wall is totally different. And you can't just say Germany or Nazi and have people applaud your
right.
analogy. That's
right.
What I say.
Yeah, I mean, and then the last line is interesting. He says, defense is dialogue, growth, acceptance, education, integration, and the healthy but human limit. So, I mean, so like when the Japanese drop a bomb on Pearl Harbor, right? What's our defense mode here? Dialogue, growth, acceptance, education? Do we send an education program on DVD to the Japanese saying, please don't bomb us again? It's hurtful.
You have to ask yourself, is it a healthy but human limit. I don't even know what that means.
I know. This is just this mumbo jumbo, and you hear it in homilies and sermons, but you especially hear it in homily and sermons by bishops. Like, we are gathered here to get today in the spirit of the freedom of the children of God to enter into the Paschal mystery and to express, you know, the human transcendent experience of what it means to be people of the resurrection. You know, it's like just on and on and on, and it doesn't make any sense.
It
sounds like Episcopal. Kind of smart. You know, you hear from the bishops all the time. It's like, you know, not even like $5 words. These are like 85 cent words, you know?
Yeah. No, you did a pretty good.
These are dollar store words.
Yeah, that's right. And you did a pretty good job approximating that.
Stacking them up. And then it'll end with an application. So let us go forth and make a difference, carrying in our hearts both Christ and the sojourner and the neighbor and the migrant, knowing that by the power of the Holy Spirit, we will all enter into that kingdom for which we all long for, which all of our hearts desire. God bless you. That's how it ends. That's
a little creepy how good you are at that. It's a little different though with, you know what that healthy but human limits reminds me of? It reminds me of something out of the new Pontifical Academy for Life or whatever life sciences. You always hear that, or the 30-point plan or whatever it was called that we cover, the EU talk.
Agenda 2030?
Like, Agenda 2030, that's what it is. You know, that's a good wall. But that looks like a healthy but canine limit. That's a doggy door. It's right. Like, what do you mean? Why do you have to keep using the modifier human, you know?
Right.
And they'd be like, well, because we're dealing with political regimes that treat in the inhumane. It's like, I mean, no one really believes that stuff, you know, unless you have an open genocide. Then it's pretty much just like, well, this country wanted to build a wall on its own. On his own side of the political border, like, it's healthy and also human. Like, you know, we don't have to keep talking about whether it's
and
human.
It can't just be healthy and human. It has to also be sustainable.
Sustainable growth. Like, sustainable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Political solution, is this defense human and sustainable?
It can't just be healthy. It can't just be human. You have to be able to sustain. How long? How long do I have to sustain?
It's just sustainable, Tim. There is no length.
Don't ask. But I mean, like, if my wife's making me a healthy sandwich for humans, like, do I have to, like, throw up, you know, cones and say, that's not a sustainable sandwich because it will only keep for 3 hours outside the... How long does it have to be sustainable for?
There's no answers to this. It's just sustainable.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, it has three syllables, so it has to be used. All right.
Yeah.
So let's get to Vigano. And Crux published this. Also, the Washington Post published this. The Washington Post article was disappointing because they just make a couple quotes and then they sort of tell you what's going on in the Catholic Church, but they don't really know what's going on in the Catholic Church because it's the Washington Post.
Yeah, they don't understand.
Yeah.
But it's impossible to be disappointed, you know, if one never had expectations to be adequated in the first place. I can't. The Washington Post can't disappoint me, but I know what you meant.
Yeah. So I think we should. I like the Crux article better. So basically, some documents came out, and what's that guy's name? I can't pronounce it.
Figueredo.
Part of TNT is God keeps us continually humble by breaking stories that involve names of people that are impossible for a Texan to pronounce.
Look, I've said it before. I'll say it again. Like, Americans, Westerners have this weird double standard about pronunciations where you're instructed. I mean, no, you're not instructed. You are admonished. You're chided that any other person of any other country that comes to America and says English words funny, like, don't laugh. That's beautiful. It's beautiful the way they garbled that word out. Okay, that's fine. Right. I mean, every other American thinks that. I snicker. That's fine. I snicker at myself, or you snicker at yourself when we say these words wrong. But it can't be both ways. If it's beautiful to garble another language word, you know, when you're speaking a foreign language.
Am I supposed to walk up to a Hispanic guy, his name is Cristobal, and be like, you know, it's really pronounced Christoforos in Greek, not Cristobal. Right. Name Christopher. What? That's kind of a jerk thing. Correct me on something. Like, well, do you say Mary with a Y in the end, or do you say Miriam? Because her real name was Miriam. You're pronouncing it wrong. I mean, come on. Yeah. Anyway.
And you say Miriam. It's like, no. Yeah. Even when I use the term, we're actually going, just because there are so many Marys in my family, cousins and whatnot, with M1, our new daughter, we're going to go. Yeah, I am too. We're going Miriam, just so it's an easy distinction. We're going Miriam Josephine. Miriam Josephine. So that's a little TNT update there.
Oh, wait, is that the new baby? The new baby's going to be Miriam.
The brand new one. The one that'll be brand new.
Man, what a great segue. I chose a random Hebraic name, Miriam.
You did. Miriam. But I'm not going to say it that way because
I'm going to correct you every time you refer to your daughter. Hey, it's not really pronounced like that.
That's not who she is.
We'll bring in some rabbis.
Miriam. Miriam. Yeah, exactly. Like it's Miriam. Just so that's where we get Mary from. But but you get the double standard. Other Americans, kind of bougie types, will be like, well, hey, bro, don't laugh when they say a word funny. Whatever. I'm not going to do an example because people will call it racist. I was going to do R's and L's, but can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
But it's like, no, that's beautiful and natural. But then it's like, okay, so when I say Figueredo, like, I'm just going to say Figueredo. And they're like, yeah, speak Italian? I'm not going through that, though. Yeah. I'm putting myself through that. It's Figueredo. Yeah.
A lot of ones come to mind right now, but we'll be accused of America's greatest social sin if we say it, so...
Yeah.
Okay, so Figueredo. Yeah. That's what we're going to say, right? Figueredo.
Yeah.
Until we're...
He's good. Who he is.
Yep. So he is a former McCarrick aide. And he prepared a 10-page report based on correspondence he collected over the years. So this is a big deal. This is an insider on McCarrick. And he basically says... Yes, the Holy Father raised the restrictions that had been in place under Benedict. Remember, at first, everybody said, Vigano's lying, Benedict didn't place restrictions, and then it came out that Benedict did place restrictions. I mean, that raised the question, we got to kind of review all of our Vigano facts here. Well, if Benedict put restrictions on McCarrick, how come McCarrick was staying in seminaries and traveling to China and apparently maybe to the Philippines too? And was staying in seminaries in Rome under Francis.
Which is still a valid question, by the way.
Yeah.
But in a different under a different light. It's not a valid question so as to exculpate or to cast doubt upon Vigano's testimony, because now that's beyond reproach. With this McCarrick letter that's come to light. But it does make me raise my eyebrows at Pope Benedict XVI. Why aren't you enforcing your own rules? It's like, have you ever been over to another family's house that has kids where the parents are like, hey, whatever, however they punish them, go put your nose on the wall or whatever. That's what we do when our kids don't do major infractions. And then the kids are just like, no, like, peace, y'all, I'm going outside. And then and then they're like, cool, so anyway, let's go back to our conversation.
Oh, those darn kids. Never do
exactly.
Never do what you want them to do.
Yeah, be strictness. I mean, there's a lot of analogies here today, but it's true. Strictness matters home to home, but at least enforce the rules you set out. At the very least, you say you're gonna go to your room and put your nose on the wall. You got to make sure they do that. Like, come on, that's natural law.
Here's a good analogy. And again, it's not perfect in the Marshall family, and I'm not 100% consistent. My kids aren't 100% consistent, but if you tell your kids, we as Catholics make the sign of the cross and we pray before we put food in our mouth at the meal. We thank God, bless us, O Lord, right? And then we eat the food. That's what we do as Catholics. And then while you're setting the table, Junior is over there putting some pasta or a meatball in his mouth, right? You gotta call it out.
Yeah, for sure.
Because over time, then everyone's going to have a dinner roll in their mouth while they're saying the prayer. So you've got to keep that consistent. By the way, everybody should be doing the dinner prayers in Latin. And you can chant it. One day I'll do a recording. Benedict Domine, nos et hic tua dona. It's the whole bless us, O Lord. It's really cool. And little kids do it. Two-year-olds do it. But here's the analogy. If you say, first we do the religious rite, then we get to enjoy the food, and you teach that to your kids three meals a day for 18 years, then when you tell them, hopefully when they're around 15 or so, you don't have sexual intercourse. You don't enjoy that reality that God created until you experience the religious rite, the ritual, right? So you have to wait. There's delayed gratification. There's a blessing. Then you get to enjoy it, right? That's a principle that you taught them for 18 years at the dinner table. Then when you say, when it comes to sexuality, you must be married in a church by a priest. Then you can enjoy sex with your spouse in a lifelong monogamous covenantal relationship. You see, this is why the little things matter.
No, it is. Yeah.
And you wonder, well, I told them, you know, now they're living with somebody. It's like, well, if over 18 years, there was no delayed gratification, life was not punctuated by prayer, blessings, sanctity, rituals, then of course they're not going to understand why do you need to go to a church and have this ritual in order for sex to be okay as God designed it.
That's right. That's right. The lack of enforcement of big invisible principles in the day-to-day will create bad habituation. We know what that does. Habituation applies to the natural as well as the supernatural, you're saying. But, and I mean, the point here is, I mean,
do you remember the skit, Get Off the Shed, Will Ferrell?
I remember hearing about it. I never saw you that remember, one.
So yeah. In the backyard, they're doing like a parent grill, you know, grilling out, holding beers.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he's like, hey, Timmy, hey, be a good boy and get off the shed for me. Right. And they go back to talking and he's like, hey, get off the shed, boys. Come on, get off the shed. And then he just keeps getting more and more passive aggressive until he's like freaking out. Have you not seen this?
I haven't seen that. All right,
you got to find that skit on YouTube or something. It's a classic. But
by the end, he's enraged and doing the Wolf.
He's like, I'm going to take you out to the desert. Yeah. Leave. Yeah. He goes, that's again, you can't be passive aggressive with kids. You just got to say, here's what we're doing. Do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess the moral of the story is you can't be passive aggressive with cardinals, you know, cardinal archbishops either, because when you say, hey, you're no longer allowed to. Well, I'm bringing this is the flip. This is like change to moles and then change back out of molality. Right. Like this is literally just this is what Pope Benedict was saying. Get off the shed. You know, he was like, yeah. you're grounded. Yeah. He's like, hey, no
Cardinal
travel.
McCarrick, don't molest people anymore. Can you do that? Just don't
be cool. Come on, boys.
Don't go to seminaries. Don't travel. Stay in your room.
Yeah. Do the right thing. And then, but when he's not doing it, when he's disobeying and is not sneaking out of his window to go back to seminaries, but he's literally coming down the stairs like, I'm leaving. And then Benedict's like, okay, cool. It's like, I don't know what happened there. And I mean, he should answer. He hears this. He should be like, my bad. You know, yeah. Everyone hears that I place sanctions on him without enforcing them, without an executive, you know, without observing my executive purview to make sure that, you know, this rule was enforced. This de facto Elba, to which I sentenced him, a kind of spiritual exile, was enforced. I didn't do it. So, yeah, I don't know. It's not that Vigano was lying. He's telling the truth. Figueredo, the McCarrick letter, makes this utterly clear. But Pope Benedict should answer.
There was some criticism of Vigano early on. You remember, Tim, because a couple, I don't know if it's one or two photos emerged after Vegano put out the first Vegano Part 1, go back and see our video on that for all the details. After that emerged, people tried to discredit Archbishop Vegano by showing pictures of Vegano at ecclesial events with McCarrick. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
There's one or two photos of that. And so the critics of Vegano said, well, if Benedict had McCarrick under restrictions and you knew about those restrictions, why are you at a public ecclesial event with McCarrick? And Vigano's response has been, I'm not the Pope. I deliver the restrictions, but I can't enforce them.
Right.
Do you think that's fair enough for Vigano?
Yes. That avails Vigano, who that doesn't avail is Pope Benedict, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's just a lieutenant, right? He's just a placeholder. It's kind of like you can't – if you're the messenger, right, for a law firm, and one of the partners sends you the little messenger to run to the court across the street and deliver some sort of brief, and they say, oh, this is on green paper, supposed to be on yellow paper in this jurisdiction, then let's say the message boy runs back across the street, tells the boss says, no, that's good enough. This kind of stuff actually happens. And, you know, ego stuff, petty, stupid.
Yeah.
This is what I hated about the law. And then literally sends back over, no, yellow paper's good enough. Then the court's not going to sanction the errand boy. The errand boy kind of just has to do. The errand boy might not even know really the nature of the argument, you know? He doesn't really know, oh, in this jurisdiction you produce, you know, whatever, like briefs on green. So that's the point. It's like, yeah, I mean, Vigano probably he's a smart guy. He's not a messenger, but he's still bound by rank.
Yeah, so, and let's remember, Vigano was the nuncio from the Holy See to the United States. So a nuncio is a Catholic ambassador. So he's an ambassador.
Right.
So ambassadors can't really execute laws or punishments on, you know, those that they're visiting. I don't really know, especially McCarrick's a cardinal, Vigano's an archbishop. Yeah, I mean,
they're messengers.
Yeah.
They're glorified messengers.
Yeah, exactly. They're actually messenger boys, kind of the right idea here.
That's why I picked that obscure analogy. It's like, you're bound by rank. You can't go back and be like, what's up, Holy Father?
It's like, you want to go to war? Like, you want to go to war with me, McCarrick?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm writing up a bill of excommunication and dropping it on your doorstep. He can't do that.
This isn't his
role.
The
only thing he can do is go back to Benedict. And Benedict, I think McCarrick, with all of his power, with all of his money, with all of his influence, knew that Benedict did not want to go to war with him in the public arena. It would be a mess.
I guess that must be what it is, because why would Benedict have placed the sanctions in the first place unless he kind of cared, sort of like the parent, you know, the parent who sends his kid to their room that knows they're just going to be blown off, sort of cares. But and why does the parent knuckle under the pathetic beta father knuckle under to his teenage boy when he just blows him off? It's because he doesn't want to go to war. So it's basically the only reason that makes sense is just like, I don't have the wherewithal at this point to, you know, just no one really knows about this sanction in the first place. So I'm not publicly shamed. He didn't know it would ever come out like that. So let's let sleeping dogs lie, or whatever stupid analogy people make when they knuckle under.
Right. Right. And it's hard to go to war.
Yeah.
You know,
No one
likes to go to war. It's much easier to have a gin and tonic and sit on the beach and read a book you like. Everybody likes that. Going to war, like, oh, man. That's how things are in my family. It's like, oh, man, I'm having this cool moment right now, but it's over. I've got to go to war.
Yeah.
You go to war, you know? We're talking about virtue. We're talking about salvation of souls.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so this Figueredo, did I say it right?
Yeah, that was a little more Italian-y that time.
All right, I'm getting good. Spent a week in Italy, and listen to me. I need to do that every year. Just a little Italian.
You get a little better each visit.
Maybe then I'll start throwing my hands, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's when you're fluent.
And start running it. Even Italian professors write in run-on sentences. Their sentence, like you're reading like their journal article. It's like a paragraph this long and it's all a run-on sentence. And I raised my hand like, never mind. I'm just the messenger. Like,
I'm just the messenger.
You can't say that to your professor. Like, you don't know how to write.
Yeah.
You don't know grammar.
So,
but
Figueredo, he was a priest of Newark, New Jersey. He was actually ordained by McCarrick in 94. So this guy goes back with ex-Cardinal McCarrick. It's also interesting. Yeah. I've learned over the years, you know, I've been in some of these circles. I've written, I say this subtly, I've written homilies for archbishops. I've, you know, met a lot of these bishops, cardinals. The personal secretaries to these guys they're firecrackers, man. They know so much. And they turn.
Yeah.
I mean, the personal secretary, when I was an Episcopalian priest, we had an unwritten rule. Never hire an Episcopalian secretary. Always hire a Baptist secretary.
Yeah.
Because the Baptist secretary doesn't care any bit at all about Episcopalians. She's just there for the paycheck. You get an Episcopalian secretary, she's going to want to know everything, all the problems, and now you have a major leak in the office. That was protocol back in the day. It's kind of like I think it's in Jerusalem, the Holy Sepulchre, that they let a Muslim, not a Christian, hold the key.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to have an outsider. So here once again, Figueredo has, in a sense, revealed what he knows about McCarrick. This is going back, I guess, to when he was ordained priest, 1994. He was his personal secretary from 94 to 95, and later acted as his go-between and personal aide during McCarrick's multiple visits to Rome over a 19-year period.
It's a long period.
So he is seeing, he's opening the mail, reading the mail, helping McCarrick write responses, probably ghostwriting a lot of the responses for McCarrick.
Right.
And then he's also traveling with them, I guess. He's personal aide on his visits to Rome for 19 years. He's at a lot of dinners.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so just think of it this way. When people lie, they don't assume that they're going to be caught in a lie. Francis was partly caught in the lie, circumstantially caught in the lie, and so was Wuerl. Because Wuerl already kind of tried to duck out of it by saying, oops, I had a lapse of memory, remember?
Yeah. Wuerl had the lapse of memory, yeah.
Yeah.
First he denied it, then he lied, then he said, oh, I had a lapse of memory.
Right.
Cardinal Wuerl,
Francis,
shameful.
Francis instead literally just said, I'm not going to say one word about this. You have the journalistic capacity to figure things out, even though, you know, how would they do that if you're the source and you're not saying things about it? Well, I guess this is the answer.
Breadcrumbs along the way that we're figuring it out.
Right. We got it. Got her done. But now he's really out of luck. And of course, we have a response by Vigano. Dated either to today or yesterday, another feast day if it's today. So he likes to do that.
He does. I like it.
Drop dimes on big feast days. Today's the Ascension. And I mean, he's really caught. And he was sort of soft caught back when he did the plane presser, when he said, I'm not gonna say one word. I mean, everyone pretty much with half a brain figured this means because you don't have anything good that will exculpate you. Well, now, you know, he's kind of the media gave him a pass for 7 months and now he's officially inculpated.
Yeah.
Isn't he? I mean,
it looks like it. I mean, Vigano's accused him of not remembering. What's the quote you have in front of you?
The Vigano. What's the actual quote?
Yeah. Where he says the Pope, did he say the Pope chooses not to remember, or how exactly?
No, pretends. He says, the Pope pretends not to remember what I told him about McCarrick. He pretends that it wasn't him who asked me about McCarrick in the first place. Mm. And he pretends not to remember what I told him. We thought this was, we were having a laugh about just the diction before, but yeah, mm-hmm. That is, I think, a careful man imputing motive, which you don't do if you're a careful man, unless you're positive. He has evidence to say, well, he's pretending. Because if somebody says something that's untrue, you don't start saying, oh, you're pretending you don't know. You assume, okay, maybe this person truly doesn't know, right? But he's imputing motive, and he's being vindicated on every detail, large or small, that he's brought to bear thus far. So, you know what? Yeah, I know where my expectations are. Yeah. V for vindication.
V for vindication is the name of this show.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, it's really interesting when that original document dropped. I mean, that's when we really got going, Tim. Was that time, right? Vigano. Right? We've done a couple shows just on politics and whatnot, but then we're like, let's jump on and talk about Vigano. And you read that original, it was 11 pages. And you read that, and it's still, you know, I think the reason Vigano is dating these with feast days is for posterity, for the future. I think he knows they're going to be collected and read as in the future, whenever we figure out this pontificate, those are going to be chronicled together. And it's going to be like, on this feast day, he said this. On this feast day, he said this. And remember, we look back and it's like, you know, St. Michael and the Rosary and all these things are pivoted on special feast days in the Catholic Church.
In church history, Tom's, when they're looking back on 2018, 2019, they're going to say, look at the carefully chosen dates here. Mm-hmm. And look at this guy knew what he was doing. I mean, there's a little bit of intellectual pride, not necessarily in the sinful way, but there's some intellectual pride in craftsmanship, right? And just not just, hey, I found this great fact that vindicates me and condemns all these bad actors in the church and just emailing them to the New York Times, right? He's finding him and having the presence of mind and the patience to wait and be like, this will be dope on the feast day of A, B, and C. And he's shown tremendous restraint, right? So this is the thing that kills me with all of the Vigano detractors out there. They don't talk loudly
anymore.
There's
not that many anymore. Yeah, they've gone away.
They have gone away by the force of fact, by the force of fact. But they would be if they could, right? Because they don't like what he's doing. But they would defend him and say that he's not showing tremendous restraint. That just kills me. You know, when like a dishonest person takes something that's your strength. It's one thing if you're in a debate with someone and they take your weakness, which is, you know, it's your weakness, and they throw it in your face and they might exaggerate it. You have this weakness more than you do. But it kills me. It kills me. It's the sense of justice giving to each his due. When your enemy or someone you're debating with takes your strength and says it's a weakness, that's what they've done to the good Archbishop Vigano. This guy has restraint beyond all restraint. You know, even intellectual restraint, emotional restraint. He gave up his life. He's in hiding. Yeah, it's just tremendous temperance. And to say that he's intemperate or unrestrained is just, that's just a blasphemy. I mean, not a blasphemy. That's just a calumny.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's still in the game. You know, I didn't think I mentioned this before, Tim, but when I was at the Rome Life Forum conference, that Burke was at, Cardinal Ike, Cardinal Brandmuir, even Bishop Schneider televised an address in. Did I tell this to you? Vigano sent greetings to the conference.
Really?
Did I tell you that?
No.
He sent greetings to
people. Yeah. Like a video.
No, he wasn't in a video. No. So Schneider was in a video from Kazakhstan. It was like piped in.
Sometimes I mix up Vigano and Schneider. You told me about Schneider's video. No, so what did Vigano say?
We had the three cardinals there that spoke, bunch of great lay leaders, scholars like Roberto De Mattei. All these guys are speaking, but Vigano just sent regards. I can't remember who it was that stood up, but said, also, everyone, I'd like everyone to know that Archbishop Vigano sends his regards to this conference. So it shows that Vigano is still alert. He's watching everything. He knows who's who. He knows who's on which team. He was proactive enough to send regards to all of us together in Rome. Yeah. So he's
striking.
Yeah, he's still very much aware and following. He hasn't just disappeared, faded away into the sunset. I think the day of Vigano may still yet come.
The Vigano of, yeah, I hope so. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to think that he's out there. He's got his daily routine. He's probably, you know, I imagine him like.
He gets up in the morning. He hits the squat rack, right? He gets his workout in. You know, maybe he goes on a jog. No, first he says his mass, right?
Yeah.
Maybe prays his rosary, knocks out most of his breviary in the morning.
Right.
Then he hits the squat rack, goes for a run.
I guarantee you somewhere in the morning routine, he's got a stack of papers. Whoever, he's probably got some helper. I like to think about it like Better Call Saul, right?
You think he's got a sidekick with him?
He does, sir. I don't know. You need someone to bring you your papers because these Europeans, how else is he going to read all those papers?
Someone has to carry them from the doorstep to the kitchen table.
Yeah. Well, or go procure them because you can't just get not that he reads La Repubblica, but you want to read opposition news. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, maybe he just.
But
does
everything's
it online.
Digital now. Yeah, I was going to say.
I like to think about it like Better Call Saul with Jimmy bringing Chuck the stack of fresh print news. But yeah, that probably is very unrealistic. But he's reading his favorite papers digitally or in print somewhere.
Do you picture him in a piped cassock with his Zucchetto, maybe like a fat cigar at the breakfast table? He's already done his mass, his workout of the day. He's got like a big. He's got Catholic Herald or something like that open up in front of him and feet up on the ottoman just getting caught up.
I don't get outfit specific in my picturings of erstwhile exiled cardinals.
Right. But you don't want to think of him in like in shorts and a Bermuda shirt.
Jeans.
Like dad jeans, you know?
It's a disappointing image.
He's got like dad jeans on and like
an America tank top.
And some... British Knights, white shoes, right? BKs, you know?
BKs. It's and, the BK.
Yeah, and he's got like a Mexican wedding shirt on.
Yeah, that would. Those don't fit anyone right, but that's
I like them. Joy got me a couple. I think once you turn 40, you can start wearing them. It's like you get the pass. And yeah. I kind of like them.
They're all kind of oversized, though. What are you wearing? Extra small in that? I mean, they're kind of for
it fits.
It fits. A heftier build. You're not. You know.
I must have got the trim fit. Maybe I don't know.
Trim fit? Yeah, I didn't know. Fit. I didn't know.
Maybe I'll wear one on the next show. I'll wear a Mexican wedding shirt. We can all decide if it's a good look or if you have to be a really old guy. Maybe it's not 40. Maybe you have to be 50 to wear it.
Leave us a comment.
Do you Carpe wear the Mexican? Diem. There's also, have you seen the Mexican wedding shirts that have collars in them? I'm kind of against these. It's kind of tacky.
Oh, yeah.
The priest ones.
I think I was given one that has a.
They have a tab collar.
A Roman collar?
It's a Mexican wedding shirt with a Roman collar, and I've seen it.
That's weird.
Yeah.
I've never seen that. No. But, I mean, I'm not I like. Mean,
maybe if you Mexican are attending an actual Mexican wedding.
If you're presiding over a Mexican wedding, maybe you could. I mean, how do you attend a Mexican wedding with a Roman collar unless you're the priest?
No, like the reception. You like show up at the reception and you've got the Mexican wedding, black Mexican wedding shirt with tab in it.
That's just confusing them.
I know.
People like, hello, father. And you're like, no, I'm your brother. Like, yeah. I'm not your father.
Hermano.
Like,
well, then why? I'm Hermano Beto.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't,
well, anyway, I don't know what he's wearing, but he's definitely not just on a beach somewhere reading novels. He's in it.
No, he's in it. He's in it to win it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I never thought he was out of it. I just thought, you don't know exactly what he reads. I have this basic confidence that European intellectual, Catholic intellectuals read, you know, they're very particular about what news they read. And he's got to be keeping sane by finding his old readage. I don't know what blogs he goes. I mean, that would be very interesting. I don't know
You think Vigano's ever seen one of our shows?
I don't know. I like to.
I think he has. He's nuncio to America. So that means that he has a special vantage point on American Catholicism.
It's true. It's true.
So
I hope he has.
I would imagine that I'm sure someone has said, hey, these guys have made half a dozen videos or more. How many videos have we made about Vigano? A lot. We've done a lot of Vigano videos. These guys have made a lot of hour-long videos on you. You should check one out.
Well, I mean, if he went to YouTube after any of the – this is sort of the meta-narrative stuff that people like. But if he went to YouTube after he dropped one of his letters or his statements, we should call them, on any of those 6-7 times – I think, you know, our videos are some of the first things that pop up. So if you wanted to see what the YouTube commentary was, then I guess
if you wanted to see Americans riffing on, I like to call them the epistles of Vigano.
Yeah, that works.
If you wanted to see commentary on his epistles, we're doing them. So I hope so. Archbishop Vigano, Your Excellency, we greet you. Pray for us.
Yes. I don't know what to do.
Were you about to do the sign of the cross?
Be still, my son. My father.
So hopefully, if you're watching, we'd love to. And again, we've greeted him before and invited him on. We'd love Archbishop Vigano, Your Excellency, to have you on. You could pre-vet all the questions. We'd love to just have a little chit chat, fireside chat. With a Mexican wedding collared shirt on, if you like. Preferably not, but if you wanted to roll that way.
We all have to be wearing Mexican wedding collared shirts. He'd be like, it was yes until you said that. Now
exactly.
No deal.
Yeah. Maybe he's on the beach and he's like, what are these Americans up to? I'm gonna read this book, Catholic Republic. You know? Maybe he's reading Infiltration on the beach.
I like to think so.
I hope so. He's got one of those. What are those cocktails they drink in Italy? I had one when I was there. A Nigaro? It's a black drink.
Sounds dangerous.
Yeah, I know. Be careful how you pronounce that one. It's got bitters in it. It's a real bitter drink. It kind of comes in a martini glass. They're all over Italy. I had one. It was all right.
Sorry, I don't know that one. I had one. It was forgettable.
Well, the problem with Italy is they don't have any whiskey. No scotch.
They do need some scotch.
Restaurant you can find, it's like, I'll have a scotch. And they're like, we don't have that.
Yeah. Like, what is that?
Like, we have grappa. And I'm like, no. That's not going to drink that.
Same thing. Like, is that some new girly drink, dude? Scotch? No, it's
Scotland?
Not.
This is not Scotland. Yeah.
It's very old and it's very not girly.
You know, another interesting thing about this story that you and I haven't talked about at all is it shows that even up until like 2013, McCarrick is openly advocating for bishops, priest friends he knows, to get bishoprics in the U.S.
Yeah.
So, you know, in this article, go and read it. This is on the Crux Now article, which is really well written, has a lot of great quotes in it. It's probably the best one out there right now. Who wrote this? Yeah, we got to give him credit. It just says author.
Author wrote it.
Crookstaff author. So author, we salute you.
Author's wanting to be like share one name and it's a weird name?
Maybe. I don't know. But it lists, you know, all these bishops that, you know, for example, let's see. I am not sure there will be, this is McCarrick. I'm not sure there will be many people looking to go to that very cold and faraway area in the north of Alaska, but I do have a real candidate and have written to Archbishop Vigano about him. So this is McCarrick. He's actually saying, I'm writing to Vigano saying, hey, I want these guys in these places. Hopefully,
it was brassy. That's brassy.
Hopefully Vegano received those and was like, shh, no, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how that works, but this is obvious that McCarrick is campaigning for bishops while he's under restrictions.
Like I said, something, I mean, no one's going to hop to attention and go do it because we said so on TNT, but come on, we have to ask, it's sort of third or fourth or maybe fifth order of business after today's, you know, this week's news breaks, but let's say fifth order of business, we do have to revisit Pope Benedict. What's going on here? You got not only a disobedient inferior that's still being active, you know, after you've ordered mm-hmm. him not to, mm-hmm. but he's brassy enough to be, he's still sending your nuncio there in America, in D.C., he's still sending him recommendations like he's, you know, in full ordinary status. What's the deal? What were you doing? I really do want to know. I mean, I don't even ask questions of Francis anymore. He's not going to answer them, and he doesn't like people that ask questions, and he rules like a tin pot dictator. But come on, Benedict, Holy Father, like, what's ex Holy Father, whatever you call it? What, please, can we get even a oops on that one? Even hearing someone say oops does. You know, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, right? One of the Beatitudes. It's a healthy thing. It's a good thing, says Jesus. It's not bad. And so even hearing someone say, oops, you know, that's a, you know, Peter Crafe says this is a half a second little act of contrition. It shows that you're not crazy.
Oops, I did it again?
Yeah. It shows that you acknowledge, oops, I did it again. Oh, is that a Britney Spears reference? Whose heart did you play with? Benedict played with all of our hearts by letting this guy off.
Oops, I did it again. I feel a meme coming now. You feel a meme on that one? I feel a meme coming out.
And that's all you. You created that meme.
Yeah.
Pretty single-handedly.
Daniel K., shout out to you. John, Son of Thunder, he's done some good memes.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, Benedict played with our hearts.
Oops, I did it again.
I can't remember the other line.
Have you gotten a copy of Infiltration yet?
No,
I haven't. Yeah, we talked
about this yesterday.
Charlie, come on, we need to get a copy to Tim here. What's going on? On chapters 29 and 30, I talk about Benedict.
Talk about Britney Spears? When do you get to Britney?
Britney's not in here. I didn't. That's the next
book. That's
weird. Oops, I did it again. The Britney Spears option. And I gave Benedict a pass on a lot of things because the story hasn't been written yet. I think people who have read the book, they say, wow, you held no punches back on Paul VI and John Paul II. And I think that's the hardest thing about reading Infiltration is the red pill on those two popes, because there is a lot of things there. But on Benedict, it's not entirely clear yet. We're still getting info. Here we are, you know, mid-2019, we're still getting more info coming out. But I do cover Infiltration under Benedict XVI, and I do cover the Vatican Bank plot with Benedict and Vigano as the key operators in exposing that, and also talk about the dossier that has all the juicy cardinal erotic disgusting horrible things and the Vatican Bank irregularities. So it's there. I mean, you don't read it and be like, wow, Ben the 16th is just such an amazing, awesome pope, just like Pius the 10th. You don't, even in my book, when I'm giving him passes on a lot of the information, you still read it and be like, yeah, there's a lot of rot in that pontificate.
Oh, yeah. There's not a lot that you could call stalwart. Like, he just stood up.
Well, I think Summorum Pontificum, and there are some things that he did a great job on, and... But
I'm not saying he didn't do anything great. I'm saying there's nothing that I would describe as stalwart. Like, he, you know, Summorum Pontificum, he knew he could sneak that in. He knew
that was pretty big. That was pretty big.
But his whole justification for it is the 1868 14th Amendment passage. It's like, well, you were never out. This was never. Right. This was never abrogated. It was never abrogated. That's what I'm looking for. So, thank you. Good work.
The Latin Mass was never. Yeah.
Yeah, but you're kind of just he. I mean,
but that was a big move.
A great deal.
Because pretty much, if you ask anybody in 1981, is the Latin Mass banned? you would have got a 99% response rate of yes from bishops, laity, priest, right, back in 81. So for a pope to later on say, no, it was never banned, it's a big deal.
No, it was clutch. But yeah. But so much in human affairs hangs on whether or not you're presuming that the other, that the party in question, in this case, Pope Benedict the 16th, is one of your guys or one of their guys, right? Because if he's one of their guys, right, if you assume going into the pontificate 2 years in, 4 years in, 6 years in, that he's a lefty, right? He did this a year and a half into his pontificate, which is cool. But if you assume going in that he's a lefty and he does the exact same thing, Summorum Pontificum, whatever you call that, disunambergate the practice of the Latin Mass. Right. And you'd be like, that's really cool. If it's one of your guys, right, and this is, I'm not saying the problem is with the mechanism here, I'm saying it's human nature because this is what's built into expectations. If it's one of your guys, you're like, yeah, cool. I mean, that's what you should be doing, and you should be following that up with a bunch of other bold action. So that's all we get into with Benedict. I mean, people when you get into this these Benedict discussions, whether it's vis-a-vis Carrick, McCarrick, or Francis or whatever, the expectations are higher for our guy. I always consider I still have a picture of Benedict up in my home. So when you figure this is a good guy, the expectations are higher. That's just how human beings are wired.
So here's a question that I don't know if we've ever directly answered, and that is, do you think Archbishop Vigano is a Benedict fan? Is he Team Benedict or is he totally Maverick?
It's a good question. He talks about him. I've noticed it before that he talks about him like friendly, like he's got a kind of paternalish, or he's got a kind of affection that he would have for his father. Paternalish would be father to son. He's got a kind of filial love for Benedict that almost Benny Plenis out there, you know, I don't want to say put your hand down because maybe this is a little bit for you, that almost sounds a little bit like maybe he still looks to Benedict as his holy father.
No, because he, in his letters, I mean, he's clearly assigning the papacy and all the jurisdiction to Francis as if Francis has that authority. I don't think Vigano is even 1% a Benny Plenist.
I can't read. And by
Benny Plenist, we mean someone who thinks Benedict the 16th is still the Pope in 2019.
We're reading tea leaves here, and that's not a reflection on my position, but when I've read each of his letters, I mean, we might just differ.
There's a paternal reverence
that he doesn't have for Francis, that he does have for Benedict. You could take that different directions. You could say that it has nothing to do with the office of the Petrine office, which might be right. But it's been the main thing that struck me. That's the main thing I could say in answer to your question. Like, and I don't know what to do with it, but that's the only thing I know. I don't know if he considers himself Team Benedict because he knows that Benedict came up short.
Yeah.
Right. It was what we were just saying. So he knows it better than I do. I kind of or better than you do. We're just putting it together letter by letter and exhibit by exhibit. But he has seen it all up close. So whatever the failures were by Benedict, he knows them really well. And so it would be hard probably for him. He's got a realistic conception of the man. You know, where you've had that experience where you know maybe a priest really well and everyone in the community reveres him, and yet you're kind of like him, but he'll joke even, you know, kind of inappropriate with you, and they're like, oh, he's like a saint. And you're like, he's a good priest, but I've heard some funny yet colorful jokes, and I don't know if saints joke that way. Maybe they do. That's probably at least how Vigano feels about it. But I don't know. What do you think? You're the one that posed the question.
Well, I think that there is, and I met a lot of people like this in Rome who are so horrified by the current pontificate under Pope Francis that there is this natural nostalgia for Benedict. But there's also, in those conversations, he let us down, he fled the wolves. I think the consensus in, I don't know what we would call this group, they don't believe Benedict is the Pope. They wish he were, but they, I don't think they really do. But it's like, we think he was a good man and he helped us, but he is deficient in the virtue of fortitude.
I think that's just reasonable Catholics everywhere. I don't know if you need a subset for that. That's just people that are like, I wish he were still Pope. Reasonable. He was smart as hell. Reasonable. He lacks fortitude. Evident as anything, you know, plain as day. And again, did I mention I wish he's still Pope? It's like, that's just called being Catholic in 2019.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree. At all.
It's sort of like, that's my real dad. And one day my real dad will come back and get mommy and me and take us in to live in a big mansion.
On an island.
On an island. One day my real dad, kind of like Little Orphan Annie, you know? One day my real dad's going to show up with the other half of the locket.
Yeah.
You know? And I'll know it's my real dad and everything will be, well, I don't think that's, sorry folks, this ain't Little Orphan Annie.
Also, ixnay on the locket. Even if Benedict did show back up,
he's got the locket's
probably not a good wrong time, wrong place.
Yeah, right.
A heart locket with the Bishop of Rome.
Yeah. So maybe it's a half of a pectoral or a part of a pectoral cross or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I think it's wishful thinking.
I can't make that joke about
my. By the way, Tim, I don't know if you know this, but I did a Thomistic analysis at the end of Infiltration. Of all the options available to us, looking at the Francis Pontificate, you can become an atheist and just say, hey, this whole thing's a joke. You can become Eastern Orthodox and just say, hey, papacy's been messed up for 1,000 years. I'll take a hard pass on that. You can become Protestant and just say, Jesus and me in the Bible, book studies about Jesus, that's Protestant. You can become Sede Vacantist. I go through that whole option and explain why I think it's wrong. And I do a very, very full treatment. I think it's the only published treatment of the Benny Plenist resignationist argument. As a Thomist, I set out their argument as best as possible and give it in its best light. And then I explain why I think it's wrong.
We also did a show on this, and I don't. Did we deal with the Benny? I mean, I don't think that one is. But all the other avenues are logically blocked, right? There is a logical path. I'm not a Benny Plenist. I don't subscribe to that. But that one, I wouldn't say it's precluded. There's no logical or logistical block. That's, I just think, unlikely that happened.
Well, what I do is I go through the Latin and I also go through the actual resignation text, the published text that Benedict himself signed. Because their big argument is that the ministerium and the munus are two different things in his mind. And this is substantial error. And since there's substantial error, there is no resignation. Right. So I go through the actual text and show that. Textually, that's not the case.
Benedict
could believe it in his mind in a crazy loony way, and he might. I don't know. But in a legal situation in canon law, the text itself is orthodox. The text itself does not make the distinction. I show that. Right? He very clearly says, I am no longer the Bishop of Rome. In the text, he even calls for a new conclave.
Right.
So I don't.
But in typical contra, I'm not a canonist, but in typical, and I'm not a Benny Plenist. I'm just saying the reason I don't think it's blocked 100% the way you can't go be an Orthodox for reasons that we've dealt with that are easy, that are light switch on off, or Protestant, obviously, or atheist. They're just, okay, that's just out. If you're a person of both goodwill and good intellect. That's understanding. Those just don't make sense. The reason I don't think that's the case is because in typical contract principles, which are first principles, if you go into a contract under duress, fraud, we were talking about these the other day when we were talking about Abby Johnson, fraud under the inducement, not sound mind, then that's got to be something like a first principle.
I would leave that door cracked. And in my book, I actually show that there might be some coercion over Benedict in his resignation. That, to me, canonically is an argument. The idea that he has a bifurcated pontificate in his mind and that he's trying to tell people about it by wearing the white and by saying certain things before the resignation, I really think that's a cul-de-sac. That's a dead end. What's more interesting, if I were a Benny Plenis and I wanted to make the argument, I'd go read Infiltration and read my chapters on that, and then I'd start finding more info and try to make an argument based on coercion.
Yeah.
And then the other one that, you know, then probably second place, and again, I don't buy any of this, guys. I've looked into it. I don't think it's right. But the second place, just being a Thomas and giving my opponent the best argument, is I would go and look at the election of 2013, the conclave, and show irregularities there because you have campaigning, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, but that would still, that would just put us in a set of a conte, because if you accepted the resignation of Benedict and then you had an invalid conclave, then you would just have no pope. So I don't know, you know, this gets into the weeds, but I do think it's worth a conversation. I do think responsible Catholics can talk about it. When I meet a Benny Plenis, and I have, I don't throw a glass of wine in his face. You know, I generally think I'm ready to hear it. Same thing with the Sede Vacantis contest. I'll listen to you. It's a complicated situation right now. I think.
Yeah, but the difference is that, well, it depends if you mean a 2012 Sede Vacantis contest or a 20 or 1950. Yeah. 1958 set of a contest, it's like, okay, I mean,
I actually think the 1958 set of a contest are more consistent than the 2013 set of a contest.
Oh, than 2013 set of a contest. Yeah, but I mean, we have all these indicia that's just a dead path. I throw them in that, right. There's just no way. As much as I'd like that to be true, see, the Bennett Plenis, not only would I kind of like it to be true, but I think there's an opening.
We really want it to be true. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, right. No, but the set of a contest, it's just, in some ways it's clean. So I'd kind of like that to be true, but yeah. I think it's a cul-de-sac. Whereas with the reason I'm delicate with this, this was brought home in the last week and a half. I know it's happened to you from time to time.
Well, Sochi's book came out too in English.
And I love Sochi. So that was another thing I'm saying. I don't want to, when we do these videos, if we were to say something defamatory about someone, not that we ever do, because we don't, but I'm very careful about that, the lawyer in me. But like, it's not just having a conversation. That's what's dangerous. It's like we're just chatting and other people just watch it, but we're publishing it. So it's like written. It's like libel. It's not slander. Same thing. Outside the context of defamation, but just in the context of personal integrity, both of us are writers and care about our, you know, believability going forward. It's very, very important to writers and thinkers. And like, so yeah, I'm not just, when I make a distinction, I'm not just trying to, and this is where, you know, everyone's got his own mind about these things, but the Bennet Plenis, I do believe there's a small chance, is what I told Father Nix, who's full on board, right? I believe there's a small chance that I'm just weighing the options. I don't think it's likely, but I don't see anything, particularly like you said, with the coercion theory. There are a number of different theories that could invalidate a contract. It's basically just contract principle. And then with, you know, with the idea of Songolan Mafia, some people dismiss that. Some of the Benny Plenis dismiss that. If I were a Benny Plenis, I'd throw all of these and say these are all possibilities. And, you know, then I guess you heighten the chances of your theory being
Bishop,
true.
Bishop Garcia has thrown it all out. I mean, not thrown it out, thrown it all into the pot. He's one that's just sort of like throwing spaghetti to the wall to see what sticks, you know.
That's wild. What, a Galveston? Is it Galveston?
No. What was his old diocese? Because Galveston is Houston. That's the currently cardinalatial seat. He's not there.
Galveston.
I want to guess Brownsville, but I don't think that's it either.
It's someplace in South Texas,
yeah,
right?
South Texas. Yeah. So, I mean, I would just respond, I think the coercion is the only good argument for the Benny Plenist. That doesn't seem to be their number one argument. They seem to want to go for the munus ministerium argument, which is, I think, flimsy and
I agree with you. Yeah.
But we have Benedict on record saying, the number one witness is the actual man. And if he did resign under coercion, he should say, but he has said repeatedly, I did not resign under coercion. So your number one witness is denying the fact that you need. So for me, we just move on. It's no good.
But that is similar. But wait, I have this argument with my brother all the time about how are you a Fatima 3B advocate without the crazy tin pot to Sister Lucy's theory? The exact, by you and you and I are both, we're of one mind on 3B, right?
Yep.
And neither of us believes in two Sister Lucy's. How? By saying that it is possible. This happens legally all the time. It happens with battered women, right? Mm-hmm. A coerced witness that at one point gave credible testimony but has circumstantial change that forces them later to say, oh, no, never mind, I didn't mean it. That's really what we're saying happened with regard to Sister Lucy. And that could also be I'm sounding like a Betty Plenis. It's just because I'm careful here. That could be the case with Benedict, right?
But with Sister Lucia, she never gave counterfactuals. She just said stuff like Our Lady received it, like the consecration of the world. But that doesn't mean that Our Lady received it as it was requested, just that she received
it. She said, and it satisfied her. She characterized it. She received it, and it satisfied her.
I don't think she said that. Did you say satisfied?
My brother's always throwing it in my face. That's why.
Brother, you need a citation, because the one I've always seen is that she received it. Even if it does say she's satisfied, it doesn't necessarily mean that it was the actual one requested.
That's my point. She's just a seer. She's just a seer. And why do you care about what she says in one time but not in another? Well, because I believe she's a seer, and I believe what she's saying about the apparition. The way to characterize it later can be errant, right? Even if her reportage of the event is.
But it's a little bit different because here we only have Benedict. He's the one who signed the document. And then you say, did you do it under duress or coercion? He says, no. I mean, but where do you go from there?
Because the coercion could be continued. He's living. We don't know what his living conditions are.
But I mean,
that's what matters.
But legally, you could never overturn that contract as long as the living witness is saying, I wasn't coerced year after year.
Well, if you could evidence it some other way besides the guy that was coerced, I don't know how you would do that. But my point is not to.
Yeah, if you could show Benedict is receiving poisoned food every day and you had some sort of evidence of that for 6 years.
Or if he's just got like a creepy, not groundskeeper guy. Remember Ben Stiller's character in Happy Gilmore with the grandma? Where he's doing this? Like every time he shows up. Toady straight down the left, dear.
Yeah,
I mean, when you're an elderly, there's that guy. And I mean, they might have hired a guy just like Ben Stiller's character in Happy Gilmore. Yeah, what is that position called that runs the old folks home with the handlebar mustache? But Happy Gilmore says his position once. I mean, there could be like that. Benedict's what, 92? He needs someone to help him like knit or whatever he's doing to occupy his time.
Well, allegedly Archbishop Ganswein is there on a daily basis. From what I understand, Ganswein's there in the morning with Benedict. He wraps things up with Benedict. He goes over to Francis.
What does he do with Benedict?
Just hangs out, talks German.
Plays the new Mortal Kombat 11 or what?
I don't know.
What were they doing?
Watch
he's
DVDs.
Retired.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not just trying to be funny. I'm genuinely curious. What do you do with a retired like 92-year-old?
So, you know, his eyesight's probably not good. I mean, I'm sure you go over correspondence and say, hey.
So darts are out.
yeah, darts are out. But Cardinal so-and-so wrote you, you know, from what I've heard, he takes no meetings unless you're like basically an old friend from Germany. Unless you have some connection with him back in Germany, no one's getting in. That's what I've heard.
Hmm. Or I guess Ganswein is German.
It's not like Cardinal, you know, Burke or Cardinal, anyone's like, hey, I'm going to go this weekend and see Benedict. I don't think that's happening at all. I think it's only if, you know, you're an old professor buddy with his or an old student of his, you know, you come into the inner circle and you can have some time, have a cappuccino.
Well, so
that's what I've heard. Don't know if it's true, but I've heard if you want to hang out with Benedict the 16th, that's the only way. Yeah. I mean, one problem just practically is if Benedict didn't really resign, that means every cardinal that elected Francis was duped, including Burke. All those guys were and are duped to this very day. And 100% of the episcopate, minus Bishop Gracita, 100% of the episcopate for 6 years has been saying Mass, consecrating the Holy Eucharist, our Lord Jesus Christ, by saying our Pope Francis in the Eucharistic canon. For 6 years, it's unprecedented that you would have the entire Catholic Church following an anti-pope for 6 full years.
Cardinals. I said, there's the remnant one, Gracita. I mean, that, yeah. As long as there's one, that makes it like.
So you're Avignon. Saying there's a chance.
So you're telling me.
Yeah, yeah.
What about all that one in a million talk?
Yeah, what about that one in a million talk?
I mean, there's Gracita. So I don't know how many were. Yeah, I mean, obviously there are three factions with Avignon. So you at least had,
right.
Say, a third, a third, a third. Probably not an exact proportion. But I mean, and I think there are a lot that suspected it. Mm-hmm. So the you know, like the Psalms read, the Lord ponders the heart. Like what about when what's her face exiled Anne
Barnhart,
who attacked you, that when she was going at it with you about like when people who are of that point of view, let's say that Anne Barnhart's point of view. They get so committal. I don't think this is the kind of issue that anyone needs to commit themselves to. That's all I've said time and again. It's like, yeah, that's the big point. I was going to make a more specific point, but I think that suffices. It's like, we really don't know. And as the information emerges, I don't know. It could. The more information, let's take situation A. Let's say more evidence arose to support that theory. Not that it has. But if it were to, then it would start to just look more like Avignon. That's how you would characterize it.
Yeah.
Oh, this is looking more Avignon.
But it's, like you said, it's more radical than Avignon because in Avignon, for argument's sake, you have a third, a third, and a third. At least a third of the people are right. Bishops, cardinals, right? In this case, you would have minus Bishop Gracita. Props to you, Your Excellency. Hope you're watching. Minus him, you would have 100% failure rate in the Catholic Church. So now you're getting to like sede vacantis levels of claims. Right?
Yeah.
Because if you're following an antipope, according to Aquinas, you are a schismatic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Thomas. Don't say Taylor Marshall said Barnhart's going to write an article and Taylor Marshall says everyone's a schismatic, whatever. No, if you are in communion, I know. If you're in Eucharistic communion, I used to like Anne. I used to read it all the time. Then one day she just came after me. I don't get it. And if you're watching, can't we just be friends? Man. Because she said that I said people should stop attending Mass, which is not what I said. I said, if you believe Benedict is the Pope, according to Catholic principles of schism, you shouldn't attend a Mass that's in communion with Pope Francis. Because Barnhart says that Francis is an anti-Pope. So if you go to a Mass that commemorates an anti-Pope, according to Aquinas, you're in schism. And schism is a mortal sin, right? So that's a problem. That's all I said. She said, I said everybody should stop going to Mass, which is not what I said. I'm just saying the position leads you, the position leads you to a very difficult ecclesiastical distinction. And there's no obvious way for that to be fixed. So when I'm looking at these positions, I'm thinking, okay, here's the actual argument. Now let's go out ripples, maybe 10 ripples out and see how that affects us today. So the sede vacantis, I read their argument. Okay, good. That means there are no cardinals on earth for decades and hardly any bishops. How do we ever get a pope again? No Sede Vacantis has ever answered that question. They say the clergy of Rome will elect him. And then you say, what, don't you believe that right now 100% of the clergy of Rome are apostates and heretics? And I'm like, yes.
Right. This is what I meant about hard Sede Vacantis.
Yes.
And then you also say, well,
don't you also believe that all Episcopal consecrations and priest ordinations from the new ordinal of Paul VI are invalid? They'll say yes. So that means all the clergy of Rome are also invalidly ordained. So now
that's
you have no cardinals.
Lineage works.
Yeah, you have no cardinals to elect a pope. And then they say, well, the clergy of Rome will elect a pope. Well, now you have no clergy in Rome. So then you have to get apocalyptic and they say, well, the Holy Spirit will descend upon a man. Peter and Paul will appear in the sky and point out a man to be pope. And so now we're getting into like really supernatural, extreme possibilities that are nowhere in the divine revelation, nowhere in the deposit of faith, nowhere in the apostolic tradition.
They're really extreme conditions for the possibility of a continued Petrine office.
So it's a big problem. So the Sede Vacantis practically are going to lead you, and then they get into ideas. Well, there's, you know, if you have no priest near you, you have to make perfect active contritions. And so they're really getting into some really oddities, theological oddities,
that in order to make the thing,
in order to make the thing endure for another 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 100 years. The same thing with the Beni Plenists is, are you willing to say that 100% of Jesus Christ cardinals and bishops are in communion and affirming and believing in an anti-pope? And are you willing to not attend Mass and be in Eucharistic communion with an antipope? Because if you're Beni Plenish, you need to be ready to be consistent in that position.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that Thomas was talking about this kind of situation. It sounds like something that nitwits will say is a bailout. I'm not sure. Nitwits are always claiming context. I'm not sure. In this, I don't know. There's a lot.
I mean, you're saying the true pope is alive and lives in Rome, but 100% of the cardinals and 99.99999%, excusing Cressida, of the bishops say that is not the pope. This anti-pope, Francis, is the pope.
I get it, but I'm saying, how can you be a formal schismatic unwillingly, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's material formal distinction here.
Yeah, because it's like, I just want to find the right church, you know, the right, you know, pontiff and follow him. I think at this point, I think it's Francis. I'm sad to say, you know, to just keep it between you and me. This isn't being recorded, is it? I'm sad to say I think it's Francis. I expect I'll continue in that, but I am going to read Sochi's book.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seemed to make a difference with at least one dude that I respect, which is Peter Kwasniewski. So I don't know. I expect to continue thinking that. But then I'm just saying canonically, it's really, really, it doesn't seem fitting, to borrow a Thomistic term, that the sensus fidelium is accountable for if there's all this. Your book Infiltration talks about all this, you know, chicanery that's happening in Rome, subterfuge. How are we have no, by design, we're not supposed to have a reference to it or any recourse to it. How are we supposed to know who to follow if so any popes are popular?
That's a good, I mean, if we're all sort of unsure on the idea, that's fine. There's no culpability. But if you are going to stand up in the public square and make a YouTube video and say, I know 100% Benedict is Pope, Francis is an anti-Pope. If that's your position, you're a hardliner, Beni Plenist, then you're not excused. You can't say, well, I'm going to go to a Pope Francis Mass and commemorate Francis as the Pope, right? I mean, for the whole polloi out there who just, you know, they don't really know, they don't watch these videos, they don't follow any of this news, yeah, they're not culpable. But if you claim, I've done the research, I know for sure 100% Francis is an anti-pope, I don't see how you can then liturgically and Eucharistically place yourself in communion with an anti-pope.
Agreed. Agreed. 100%. That's the statement that you made that Barnhart seemingly willfully took out of context. Yeah. What we should do to wrap this bad boy up, this part of the discussion, there is one other McCarrick fact I got to get out from.
Yeah, I got one more too.
Revelations that, yeah. Okay, that are important.
Yeah.
Or just even like us. I mean, we're not hoi polloi, but I've looked into it. I can't tell. I don't have the information to make the call.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a Sede Vacantist, I would say the same thing. If you believe there is no pope, you can't go to a mass where it says our Pope Francis. It's a liturgical lie. It's inconsistent, right? I mean, the mass is the most holy thing on earth. The Roman canon, which is the core of the mass, is the most holy part of the mass. So if there's a sin or a lie in the canon of the mass that is declaring an anti-pope to be the pope, I just don't see how any moral person could say that's okay. We're going to insert a lie, an ecclesiastical lie, into the most holy text of the Catholic liturgy on earth. I just don't see how that's consistent. All right, so one more thing here on the McCarrick Pope Francis thing is, not only was he influencing the bishops, but also the nuncio. So in January 27, 2017, this is from the Crooks article, letter to Francis, McCarrick mentions rumors that the Trump administration might be considering George Weigel, a noted Catholic commentator and biographer of Pope John Paul II, to the ambassador's role. But McCarrick intervened. One of the names mentioned was that of George Weigel, McCarrick wrote, a prominent Catholic voice in the United States, of one of the biographers of John Paul II. He is very much a leader in the ultra-conservative wing of the Catholic Church in the United States and has been publicly critical of your holiness in the past. Many of us American bishops would have great concerns about his being named to such a position in which he would have an official voice in opposition to your teaching, McCarrick wrote to Pope Francis. I would be happy to discuss with you and also with high officials of the Curia, he wrote. There's no indication in the correspondence of whether such conversations ever took place. In the end, Trump nominated Callista Gingrich, wife of former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, to be the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See. I've heard that Callista Gingrich has been doing great work. I don't want to get on a fight on that, but it is interesting to see that already McCarrick is lobbying against George Weigel when he's under restrictions.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, if Weigel is an ultra conservative, then what are we? You know, I mean, that's a real characterization and a half there. But yeah.
Well, if you go back in time under the pontificate of John Paul II and Ben the 16th, George Weigel was on the far right. It's just the goalposts have moved with Francis, right? So that's the difference.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So that was my last point that I wanted to make, that it's not just bishops, but also other appointments. Did you have anything else you wanted to add to that before we do important Latin word of the week?
You know, the Crux Now article, we have speculated here. It's been Raymond Arroyo has speculated. I think Papal Posse has. And that speculation about this finer point regarding McCarrick in China seems to be vindicated by this Figueredo correspondence.
Yes.
In November 2014, I'm reading from Crux Now, McCarrick wrote Figueredo again to say he'd be leaving for China, for Rome, on Thanksgiving evening and returning December 1st. He also thanked Figueredo for his, quote, recent help, saying, quote, it may have made a great difference in our China policy.
Ooh, boom.
Yeah, that's McCarrick told Figueredo, I am sure that Cardinal Parolin would see me, quote, during an upcoming Rome stay, quote, begin quote again, since he is involved with my China trip. To sub boom. I mean, that
puts Parolin in on it.
Yeah, who? Yeah. I don't want to.
Which is not a surprise.
10 fights away. It's not a shock. That's all.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. So that I mean, watch, what is tonight, Thursday? What is today, Thursday? Oh, yeah, whether we're recording this. Yeah, I'm going to go watch, me some World Over and see, because Raymond Arroyo has been all over the China thing.
Yes.
I mean, he's all over all this stuff we're usually talking about, but he's covered China with much more detail than we have, and boy, yep. That's a bombshell.
And I also want to say I think we broke this before anyone else back in the fall of 18, because I said back in 2007, I hosted and recorded at the Catholic Information Center Cardinal McCarrick giving a talk on the church in China, in which he stated we need to recognize the patriotic church and not just the underground church. And everyone in the room, I think even George Weigel might have been at that talk. Everyone in the room was like, did the Cardinal McCarrick just say that? That's not right. That's not been the teaching of John Paul II. So I heard that back in 07. And so when I read the Vigano document where he said McCarrick was going to China, I knew exactly what McCarrick was doing in China, because I heard that talk back in 07 by McCarrick in D.C. So there it is.
Fishy. Okay,
so
I mean, it's beyond fishy.
It is. So we have two really bad things, folks. We got McCarrick's sexual scandal in America, which has cost us dearly and hurt so many souls like James Grine. And now we have McCarrick's China policy, which has been implemented by Francis, which is hurting millions of Catholics and people in China. Not good. Not good. All right. Latin word of the week. We chose fetus.
Fetus. Yeah, this is a word I've been talking about a lot as I talk Catholic Republic. Fetus means a treaty, which is a sovereign international immunity principle. The reason it's interesting in the context of
that's not
of
what
American
it really meant in Latin. We got to define it in Latin. That's the American.
It means covenant.
You
mean covenant, pact, treaty.
Yeah, it's etymologically related to this Indo-European word bade, which is where we also get the word for faith. Like sola fide, faith alone, right? So it's not a direct relationship, but it does have a proto-Indo-European, which means to trust, to confide. So that's what a treaty is. You trust each other, right?
Yeah, but the point with regard to treaties is the reason you're trusting each other by good faith is because it's a sovereign international immunity principle rather than...
Right.
See, in America, we have these two systems of government, right? We have federalism, which means there's a national government, and then there's a federal government, which comes from fetus. The federal is supposed to mean the states. Now we use it to say national, but the states were relating to each other the first 100 years of the country,
right,
like little sovereign international independent states, and they're basically what a treaty was, is different countries coming together basically in good faith to fight a war together, like a League of Nations. That's all the states were under the Articles of Confederation. They were slightly more conglomerated nationally under the new Constitution of 1788-89. But the point is, we have all these treaty gov terms. Congress also has a treaty government term, not national government term. Fetus, I forget. There are a few others we use and recognize that are all sovereign international immunity principles. But it's a pact, a covenant, a treaty taken in good faith.
Yep.
And it has profound political implications for American federalism that would surprise most people.
Legit Latin word of the week. Okay, so we'll close in prayer. And before we do, pray that rosary every day, as we always say. That really needs to be stressed, that the rosary is the weapon. The Bible is the sword, but the rosary is the weapon. And so we can break the strongholds of the demons of our enemies. It's another thing. Our enemies aren't necessarily humans. Paul says ultimately our enemies are the demons. So in order to obstruct the demons' work, we ask Our Lady to crush the head of the serpent. And we do that chiefly through the beads, the rosary, the gospel on beads. So, okay, let's pray. And
wait, quick.
It? Yeah.
One real fast. One question a lot of people out there have, and I have, I mean, I'm just a Quoque, what do you do? If I do mine at night a lot, and sometime I wasn't doing this during Exodus 90 because I was real diligent, but or in Lent, but outside of Lent or Exodus 90, when I'm doing my daily rosary, a lot of times I do it at night. I fall asleep in the middle of it. I mean, there's no hard question here. It's just literally, what's your point of view? A priest once told me that as a seminarian, they said their guardian angels finish it. I usually try to finish the next morning. Yeah. So I end up doing decades 4 and 5 of the last night's rosary, and then I end up doing 1, 2, 3 that day. So usually I'm still doing a rosary or 4/5, but it's a real problem if you do it at night.
It is. It is. So what I like to do, on Sundays, I try to pray 15 decades, try to do the whole thing, 150. But as I've said before, I pray a lot of rosary during, before, during, and after Mass. During the offertory, I'm praying the rosary. During the consecration, if I'm not, you know, overseeing a child who's being naughty, I'm praying the rosary. So I'm praying a lot of rosary in Mass. So I usually can get at least 5 decades in during the, people are horrified when they hear me say this, but. It's piety, no,
me
folks.
Too. Me too on Sundays. It's the day I never am at a loss. But the other days.
And so then we do a family rosary at night. So that's another 5 decades. So I easily on a Sunday can get 10 decades. And my goal is to get the 15. But then we pray the rosary as a family after dinner before bedtime.
Every night?
Yeah.
Okay. You can do 5 decades. Yeah, a lot of times
sometimes
we'll just do one or two.
End up doing, because like if it's a Saturday night, or if it's a Monday and the kids are tired from the weekend, we only end up doing 1 or 2 as a family.
Yeah.
But then I'll have to finish them later.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I'll do 2 after dinner a lot of nights, 2 or 3, and then I'll be doing 1 or 2 at night. It depends how quickly I fall asleep. Yeah. So whatever. I was
you do what you can do is what I would say. I mean, it's not a sin if you don't finish it, obviously. So you do what you do, and if you get four decades in, great. You got 4 decades in. That's what I would say.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
Okay. So
we'll pray.
You'll pray, and then we'll sign off. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. Mighty God, we thank you that you have sent your Son, Jesus Christ, to be our good shepherd. He is guiding over us, the sheep. He will lead us into green pastures. He will lead us into salvation if we follow, even in these hard times. So we ask that you would give us graces and signal graces and continue to strengthen us by the sacraments and by your sacred scriptures. And we ask that you would bless everyone watching with us today, and that you would guide them and give them consolation and hope. In Jesus' name, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death.
Amen. St. Thomas Aquinas, pray for us. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. All right, folks. Well, thanks for watching. Please subscribe. Please like. And we'll see you in the next video.